are here this morning on the OLR versus Kyle Hansen. I understand that the attorney for Mr. Hansen would like to do part of his oral argument in a seated position, and I have granted that. I understand he may decide to stand for rebuttal, and that's fine too. So I don't know if I should call you Judge Dykeman or Attorney Dykeman in any case.
Throughout this case, I have been Attorney Dykeman.
Okay, so that's what we'll rely on. But in any case, you may choose whatever works for you. I'm sure opposing counsel will okay that as I have, correct? All right. Are you ready to proceed?
I am.
Please do.
I am Charles Dykeman, and I live in Winona, Wisconsin. I represent appellant Kyle Hansen. My co-counsel sitting next to me is Christina Cavanaugh of Barrington, Illinois. Attorney Hansen and
Mr. Dykeman,
yes.
Would you please pull the microphone closer to you? I know it interferes with your papers.
Put it off to the side, Judge Dykeman, and then you can twist it around. It twists a little.
Will this work?
Yes. Well, I think that's better. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for letting me know. Attorney Hansen and his father are here also. This is an important case for Hansen. If found guilty, he could still be charged with perjury for testifying at the referee's hearing that he did not know of a date for a summary judgment motion until after he incorrectly told a court they had not received a notice of the date. He might be asked by a prospective client if he'd ever been disciplined by a court. In early 2013, Kyle Hansen was a very young attorney, having graduated from the UW Law School in 2011. The case underlying the complaint here was the fourth case Hansen tried. Hansen was a member of his father's law firm in Illinois. He practiced from his home in Madison, Wisconsin most of the time. You will read of his inexperience in the transcript of an August 22, 2013 hearing in the circuit court case underlying this case, Munshaw versus Schmidt, Green Lake County. For instance, in Munshaw, Hansen's motion papers accused opposing counsel, Attorney Misero, of having an ex parte communication with the court by obtaining a date for the motion hearing. He also asserted that notices of motion hearings were always sent out by the judge, not opposing counsel. Of course, Hansen knows differently now. The issue underlying this case is whether OLR must prove Hansen's guilty knowledge or knowing misrepresentation or lie when Hansen wrote to a circuit judge on May 14, 2003, claiming, "I did not receive notice of the May 8, 2013 hearing date for defendant's motions in limine summary judgment and for sanctions." The statement was incorrect. Hansen admits that he failed to read the entire 144-page summary judgment document that Misero sent, including one page of which contained a notice that the three motions would be heard on May 8, 2013. Thus, Hansen didn't appear on that date. He has conceded negligence because, in the exercise of ordinary care, he should have read all 144 pages of Misero's motion pages, but he didn't, and that's where this disciplinary case started. Misero prepared a notice of the default and sent it to Hansen. Hansen again read some of the 144 pages and doubled down on his negligence by again not reading the page containing the May 8 date and by writing his May 14th letter, which prompted Misero to file this complaint with OLR.
Now, he didn't appear then on May 8th.
No, he did not, and his client was defaulted.
Okay.
Hansen is aware of the standards of review applicable to this case. OLR had the burden of proving Hansen's guilt by strong, clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence. That's SCR 2216-5. Here, Hansen has the burden of showing infirmities in the referee's findings of fact. Additionally, because Hansen is asserting that the evidence was insufficient to convict him, Hansen has the burden of showing that insufficiency.
Now, there are two charges here of two different sections, right?
Right.
And do you read them both the same? Because it seems to me that one talks about knowing, and that's defined, actual knowledge or reason to know. And that the other one deals with perhaps something less than knowing.
I don't think that the 28.4C has something less than knowing in it, just because it doesn't use the word knowing.
Well,
the reason is...
Counsel, doesn't 8.4C include misrepresentation as an act of misconduct?
Yes, that is, I believe, one of the definitions.
And misrepresentation is defined as communication of an untruth, either knowingly or with reckless disregard.
Yes, it does. And I will argue some in the later that reckless disregard was never raised or argued other than using the two words once in the referee's hearing. And so I did not, I believed that if OLR does not raise an issue, I am not required, Hansen's not required to respond to it. I don't believe Hansen is required to essentially try OLR's case for them.
What if we were to determine that Mr. Hansen's actions were not done with knowledge? Would that require us to remand to determine whether or not he acted with reckless disregard?
No, because I think in this situation, the record shows exactly who said what and when. And as a result, I think this becomes a matter of law. On the other hand, there is significant case law. I haven't gone into it in any depth, but there's significant discussion of what is this reckless disregard, and does reckless disregard require some kind of intent? And then, are the actions that Hansen took, is failing to read a statement, or is failing to read in a motion a reckless disregard?
Well, when one is making representations about what is contained in a set of documents, would it not be acting with reckless disregard not to check them first?
No, I don't believe so. I think it's certainly negligence. But reckless disregard is far more than negligence. It needs,
it's not defined in the code.
No, it's not defined in the code, but I will explain later that it's certainly something more than negligence. And that's the problem, is trying to decide what is reckless disregard.
Well, I looked up reckless disregard for legal definitions, and there are a number of different definitions, but it says having or showing gross negligence or conduct without any thought as to the consequences in civil cases. As negligence itself is usually actionable, seeking recklessness is perhaps to over-egg the pudding. Not having made pudding myself, I don't know what that means.
Nor do I.
In criminal matters, negligence is seldom sufficient. So reckless conduct is always difficult in criminal matters. That said, most systems have found it a place, either in intention for crimes or separate. Reckless, careless, disregardful, foolhardy, foolish, hasty,
heedless, impetuous, improvident, imprudent, impulsive, inattentive, incautious, inconsiderate, indifferent, indiscreet, injudicious, insensible, irrational, irresponsible, mindless, neglectful, overconfident, and on and on and on, without caution, without prudence, reckless abandon, reckless conduct, reckless disregard, reckless driving, reckless indifference. Like shooting a gun in a public place is reckless use of firearms.
Well, that clears it up.
That's right. That's how I felt about it.
Well, is part of your argument that there's a failure of notice as to what reckless disregard imports in regard to conduct?
Well, the issue was never tried. And so there never was any issue in front of the referee. So I'm dealing, I guess, at this point with something that nobody knows much about. And the best I think I can say is, I think that a fact finder would have had to go into the knowledge that Mr. Hansen had, and my argument would be, well, to litigate that point, my argument would be that he was just barely 2 years out of law school, and as I have shown in my examples, he was woefully ignorant of Wisconsin law, and that is exactly what the judge in the trial court in the Munchau matter found.
So much for our diploma privilege?
Well, I'm not sure I really want to go into that.
Okay, but he did graduate from the University of Wisconsin Law School. That's my alma mater. Is that yours?
Yes, it is mine. And what I have learned is that because I, in order to be admitted to this court, I had to take a course in how to practice law. And I found that course was far more important to me in practicing law than anything the law school taught me. The law school gave me a wonderful background in how to find out what the law is, but it didn't tell me where the courthouse was.
Well, reckless disregard is what we seem to be a bit concerned about, and you're saying that that was never argued or tried in front of the referees. Am I right?
That's correct. I think one time OLR used those two words, but in citing the rule.
So you're saying the proof is insufficient because they didn't prove reckless disregard?
Well,
I'm not sure what we're doing with this. So.
Okay. Well, I would say that if that came up, and if that's really the issue, then that issue needs to be found as a fact. What does it mean that Hansen was barely out of law school?
Attorney Dykeman.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No problems. As Justice Abrahamson read the definitions, recklessness seems to cover a lot of territory. And if, hypothetically, the court were to find that, I'm not sure that requires a factual finding. I mean, we have the record before us, and you said earlier it's all the record has been laid out in front of us. We're in as good a position as anybody else to review the record and apply the law to it to make a legal conclusion. And it seems to me whether conduct was reckless is a legal determination, not a factual one.
Well, I think that, for instance, what about Mr. Hansen himself? Supposing he had some type of disability, then that's going to have to be a finding of fact, I think, in order to determine just what he knew. His knowledge of the law, I think, is an important fact. How he had prepared for this case is another fact that I think needs to be found. And really, I think the big item here is that OLR, other than citing the words, saying the words, reckless disregard, has not cited anything to show OLR's case of why this might be reckless disregard. Well, so I go ahead.
Tell me, please refresh my recollection. What have they shown? What have they pointed to demonstrate that it was intentional? In addition to the finding of the referee, in other words, what was the referee's basis in the record for the referee's determination that it was intentional?
The referee, I think this is the underlying point that I'm making. The referee found that Hansen knew of the May 8th date. Now, to a layperson, that person might
what,
say...
What did the referee point to as a basis, as a factual basis for that for that conclusion?
He made 8 findings in which he came up with language of that sort that Hansen knew. None of these findings go any further than that. They do not say why it is that Hansen knew before May 14 that this was not correct. So I saw nothing there.
Well, how about this, counsel? In the motion for reconsideration, Mr. Hansen says, quote, "In any event, plaintiff's counsel did not see the date listed by the defendants, and neither counsel nor the firm's assistants took the date as the scheduled date," close quote. That section at the end there, that last clause, "took the date as the scheduled date," doesn't that indicate to you that he was aware of the date at the time that he was writing the letter?
No, it does not, and that's because of the facts in this case. Hansen wrote that, not being aware of it, because what he was writing was a motion for reconsideration. And he knew in the motion for reconsideration that he had to show excusable neglect. And therefore, his motion tells us that in any event, he didn't understand that. It wasn't a knowing thing.
Well, isn't just based on what you said now, isn't it a natural reading of the sentence to indicate that he read the date at the time, but did not understand that date as the scheduled date?
I don't think that is a reasonable inference.
Okay, so then you need to help me walk through the language then. When he says neither the counsel nor the firm's assistants took the date as a scheduled date, to what date are they referring?
They are referring to May 8.
Correct. As recorded where?
As recorded on one of the 144 pages of the motion for summary judgment.
Right. So shouldn't we understand this as Mr. Hansen saying in his motion for reconsideration to get relief from the decision on summary judgment, look, I saw the date in the motion package, but I didn't understand that as being the actual hearing date. Shouldn't we understand it that way?
No, and I think not, because that does not take into consideration the fact that Hansen believed at this time, albeit erroneously, that only courts set dates. Attorneys do not set dates, as far as Hansen knew at the time. So it's perfectly natural that if that's your belief, and you see that an attorney has set a date, that your conclusion is going to say, what on earth is this attorney doing? because I was waiting for the judge to set a date.
Right, but isn't that a concession that he saw the May 8th date in the motion package, but simply understood it not to be the actual hearing date?
I think so, that he did not understand it to be the actual. He used court, the date that the court set it. He did not understand this as anything more than a suggested date by an attorney, because he thought that only courts set dates.
And that's the part that kind of threw me when I was preparing for this case. As if it was a suggestion, wouldn't it have been styled as a, I mean, how could it have been styled as a declaration that the hearing was going to be on a date if it was actually a suggestion? And wouldn't it have at least prompted a lawyer to make a phone call for clarification?
Yes, it would have, but he didn't, and that is negligence.
Well, could it arguably be included in the broad definition that Justice Abrahamson read us in regard to recklessness?
I don't think so. I don't think so, because what we're dealing here with is an attorney who, as the trial court said, just doesn't understand Wisconsin law and procedure.
But Attorney Dykeman, you know as well as I do that we don't base the standard on an individual attorneys. It doesn't vary from individual to individual. They're held to a certain standard. And so,
I think further, there were in this packet three blank notices that on the blank day of blank, such and so, something will occur. And that induced Hansen to believe, as I think is undisputed, that it led him to believe that there wasn't a date set yet. It wasn't given by the court.
Here's how. Go ahead. This court has previously addressed the issue with regard to what is necessary for a violation of SCR 20.8.4C. And we said in the Mulligan case that a violation of that provision can be based on an attorney's carelessness and neglect. A finding of wrongful intent is not necessary to prove a violation of that section. As I recall your brief, you distinguish Mulligan and you say, well, it's different facts than here. So give me the argument as how you get around this language in Mulligan, interpreting the misrepresentation set forth in that section.
Well, first of all, I don't know, I think I put it in my brief, in order to find out where did that phrase come from, you have to go to the citations.
You went to Ritter, I think you said it came right out of Ritter.
It came right out of Ritter, and reading Ritter, what the court said was OLR has argued that you don't have to prove knowledge. Now, saying that OLR does not have to prove it is certainly nothing that the court said. And so I don't see Mulligan as going anywhere. In addition, a later case, which was Riley, which was decided this year, very, very clearly said that there has to be this knowledge. So I didn't spend a lot of time on Mulligan, but I think that if it is moderately closely examined, that it becomes obvious that it doesn't go anywhere.
Here's how I read all of this, that is your argument, rather simply stated. One, he says that he didn't get notice. Notice is a word that can be interpreted at least in two ways. One, he never got any of this material. Or two, he got it, but that he's really using the word notice to mean knowledge, that he didn't understand it. So you can say, well, I didn't get notice of that because although I got the papers and it told me that it was May 8th, I didn't dig it as May 8th being the final day. And on the interpretation of the two SCRs involved, one requires knowledge. The other requires either knowledge or reckless. Then yet your position is because OLR didn't stress reckless, because that wasn't debated in an evidentiary issue at the before the referee, you've knocked it out, and therefore you're left with knowledge in both places. That hasn't been proved sufficiently.
Well, I think it's more of a question of waiver or forfeiture.
Of whom? By whom?
By OLR. Of that issue by OLR.
Of the issue of recklessness.
That's correct.
Okay. Okay. You come out the same way. It just wasn't. It's really not in the proceedings as far as you're concerned. Therefore, you're left with knowledge in both places. And negligence is out because of Mulligan, Ritter, and Riley.
Well, I think negligence is out because of the jury instruction 1005, which talks about it as non-intentional.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. Are you prepared? Yes, please. Please go forward. You may want to raise the podium a little bit before you get started. Why don't you wait just a minute until our marshal can get back and the static is cleared up so we're all hooked up. We are good to go.
Thank you, members of the court. It's an honor once again to appear before you. A couple of your new members as well, I've not seen before, and it's always a privilege to be here. I'm Robert Crone. I'm retained counsel for OLR. First of all, there's a couple of really basic things that we're losing track of here. The letter that Hansen sent to the trial court after the summary judgment was granted to the opposing counsel stated that he, quote, did not receive the motion for summary judgment. It didn't say he didn't see it, he didn't read it, he didn't appreciate it, it was sent ex parte, ignore it, he said he didn't receive it. That was the falsification, that was the predicate for the two charges OLR has brought. The one charge is the 3.3A1, 20:3.3, knowingly making a false statement of fact to a tribunal. Now knowingly includes not only actual knowledge, but includes knowingly or knowledge can be inferred from the circumstances. This is the definition 20:1.0 under terminology. So knowingly can be inferred from circumstances. So then you go to the next count, which is a misrepresentation, 20:8.4c, and misrepresentation has two arms to it, knowingly, again, which can be inferred from the circumstances, same definition, same rule, same definition, I mean.
Mr. Crone,
reckless disregard.
Mr. Crone, I apologize. Could I back you up just about 45 seconds to your characterization of Mr. Hansen's letter? I think it was a little bit perhaps narrower than you stated. He said, I did not receive notice of the May 8 hearing date for defendant's motion in limine summary judgment and he's anxious. You had mentioned that he said he did not receive the package. I don't think that's what the letter says.
I'm sorry. I can get the letter, but if you quoted it accurately. But the point is that he did not receive it.
But notice, he received the motion, but not notice of the date. I mean, that's the way I read that. But if that's a misreading, I have to go back and look at it.
Yeah. I'm taking that from your complaint. You want to look at your complaint, it's in paragraph 18.
Okay, I'm looking at Exhibit 6, that is the actual letter in which he says, I did not receive notice of the May 8, 2003 hearing date for defendant's motion in limine for summary judgment, yada, yada.
Right, and you can read notice to mean knowledge. I didn't know it was a May 8th, even though the letter stated May 8th, because, says counsel, he thought the court, not the party, sets the date. I mean, that's what he's telling us.
Okay. I don't buy that myself, but I understand
that. Yeah, that's the argument.
I understand. So, this business about intent is really not required under either section. And counsel says, well, we didn't raise the issue of reckless disregard. Well, reckless disregard is an element of misrepresentation, which is a foundation of the rule. It's like we prove facts, and do those facts fall under these definitions? We think they do. We don't have to, in a negligence case, we don't have to say you didn't raise that ordinary care. Ordinary care is such and such and such. It's such. The fact of the matter is the referee's findings are not clearly erroneous, and Hansen has unnecessarily, in my view, complicated a very simple case here, talking about his state of mind. He didn't appreciate the motion. He didn't receive it. He didn't read it. He didn't understand it. It's an ex-party communication. All of this is kind of jumbled together. And the fact of the matter is he made a misrepresentation to the court. The trial judge, in hearing the motion to reconsider his ruling on summary judgment, rejected all of these excuses, rejected all of this analysis. And knowledge can be inferred from the circumstances. And what are the circumstances here? What are the facts, as Justice Gableman was trying to get at, that permitted this judge, the referee, to make his findings? What are the facts that show that he did, in fact, receive the notice? Well, number one, it was sent by mail, and Mr. Mesereau, who sent it, said he mailed it to that address that was provided by counsel, by the respondent. It was never returned. The motion in the first paragraph gave the date. A standard motion document gives the date first, and Mr. Mesereau is a senior attorney that's been practicing for years, and he said the notice goes on top. Perhaps a cover letter might have been on top of it, but it wasn't buried in 144 pages. It's usually on the top. No reason to think it wasn't here. Another factual bit of information, the motion was filed in court. Another factual bit of information the referee considered was that about 1 month before the hearing date for summary judgment, the respondent here, Mr. Hansen, went to a mediation session and was heard referring to the pending summary judgment motion in a phone conference. Another interesting fact here is that Mr. Mesereau, 15 days before the hearing date for the motion, called Mr. Hansen on the case and reminded him that there was a pending summary judgment motion.
Did he remind him of the date?
I don't know that.
Okay, because the claim here is that he knew there was a motion for summary judgment. He just didn't understand that the date that was in the papers was the date. So it's not that he didn't know about the motion for summary judgment. I don't think that's his argument.
Okay, but then there is a status. Well, so then he does not show up. Mm-hmm. And after the fact, after the motion was granted, at a status conference, and or in a motion to reconsider, he acknowledges that he received the motion.
And that was after the May 14th letter, correct?
Yes. Okay. And
so does this case stand for the proposition that whenever a court date is missed by a lawyer, they should have a disciplinary action filed against them?
Not at all. No.
Okay, why not?
Well,
what's different? What makes this something that, I mean, lawyers are human. They miss court dates from time to time.
Lawyers are human and they miss court dates. I've been guilty of that. But normally you inform the court in a timely fashion, and you don't send something to the court that suggests to the court that you didn't receive the notice or didn't appreciate it or didn't know anything about the hearing. If you just didn't, if this is a case where he had a procedure in his office where a secretary would calendar these motions and she didn't do that, that'd be a different case. I don't think the OLR would prosecute. But the fact that he affirmatively took steps to mislead the court to think that he just didn't get this motion or didn't understand the date of it, either one, is a misleading statement to the court. And that is something that I don't think our court system can tolerate.
Well, it's misleading only if he had reason to know it was untrue when he said it, right?
Well, and I think he did because of these facts from which you could create an inference that he was aware of the motion and the date.
Right. So that's two different things, though, isn't it? So the facts that you've recited suggest that indicate that he knew there was a pending summary judgment motion. Right. So that's clear. I don't think they're contesting that. But that's not the issue. Right? The issue is, did he know the date when he wrote the May 14th letter? And none of those factual recitations you provided just now have any knowledge of a date at all.
Cannot you refer that he acknowledged the date, he had the documentation, he acknowledged having the documentation, he was reminded of the motion, there are proceedings before the motion dealing with issues that are ultimately going to be a part of the motion. I mean, this is, obviously this is a novice attorney, but at some point in time you would think he would have looked at the file and would have seen the date on the motion if he didn't see it originally, which I think was
counsel,
the case.
What about his letter alleging ex parte communications because of setting a hearing date? Doesn't that show that either he knew there was a hearing date or he didn't know there was a hearing date or he didn't have any idea about how hearing dates were arrived at? What does it show?
What specifically did he said? What does it show?
Yeah, I mean,
ex-party business, yeah. It shows, I think, an attempt to deflect responsibility from himself for not attending the court session.
Would you stand in front of the microphone?
It reflects an option on his part or a chance on his part to see an opening to defer the blame to somebody else, to the other attorney, for sending this ex-party communication.
Mr. Crone, I thought that in the ex-party communication section, there's an exception that says when you're dealing with an administrative matter like setting a date, you can communicate with the judge and you don't need to the other party there, and that's not an ex-party communication in violation of the code.
That's absolutely right, and in fact, the trial judge in this case looked at that issue and said essentially the same thing. Attorneys are calling the courthouse all the time to get dates. It's not an ex-party
communication. But doesn't that allegation show that he didn't know that attorneys called and set up dates? I mean, you can look at it two different ways. I guess you could look at it as you're suggesting that he did it to try to point the finger at the other guy. But if he's pointing the finger at the other guy, he doesn't know the law. Because if you practice more than a few minutes, you have to call the courts. Usually you don't talk to the court. You talk to the secretary, whoever answers the phone, and say, can you give us a date for a 20-minute motion?
If you practice for more than 5 minutes, when you get a motion in the mail dealing with a case that's pending, the first thing you do is look and see when it's going to be heard by the court.
I get all of that. I was just trying to put together his allegation that the communication with the judge to get the hearing time, which opposing counsel says is how he got it, was ex parte. I mean, you wouldn't make that allegation if you knew that that's okay to do. That's how you get a hearing date is called court.
I don't think that's the case here. I think he was looking for ways to deflect responsibility.
Okay.
I believe that sincerely because other efforts are made to do that.
Okay.
For instance, as Justice Kelly pointed out, in the letter or in the documents he filed after the fact, he said he did not see the date. And then he said neither counsel or assistants took the date as a scheduled date.
Exactly where I'm going. What are the facts? Are the facts here, as you understand it, that
that he didn't see the date?
You know, he didn't read it. There were 140 pages or whatever, and he didn't read it.
Is that the fact? I don't see in the findings of fact this narrowly focused. Is the fact that he didn't see it, or is the fact that he saw it but was under the impression it did not have great consequence because only the court schedules the date? Did he see it or didn't he see it?
Well, you'd have to ask him that. Oh. I mean, his position is kind of fluctuated. Initially, I thought he was acknowledging that he received it and saw it, and then ultimately said, no, he didn't see it. And then he said something about, nor did his assistants see it. His assistants never testified in this case. And there was no corroborating evidence for his position that he was oblivious to this date. There's a lot of corroborated evidence that the referee found that the date was there, open, obvious, on the second page of the packet sent to him of a pending case, and there are reminders on the trail here about this date.
There are a lot of times, I mean, as a trial court judge, thousands and thousands of cases. You know, I mean, it didn't happen every day, but lawyers make mistakes. They miss court dates. They blow it. Sometimes, I mean, good lawyers on occasion make an honest mistake and miss a court date. What's the difference here?
The difference?
You keep going back to he must have known, he should have known. I don't disagree with you, okay? He should have had this right. He didn't. But what translates that into, I think, what you're saying is he lied to the judge.
What statements do you point to?
Making a false statement. Well, I'm relying on the letter to the court, the letter that I quoted earlier, about his not having received this document.
No, not having gotten notice of the date.
He's saying he never got the document? That's what he said?
No, he didn't say that.
Okay, well, that's why I'm trying
that
to
That goes out. Back to the different definition again that Justice Abrahamson pointed out, that notice can have different meanings. It can mean I never received the physical document, or I received the physical document and I did not comprehend its import. And so that leads into my next question. What is the OLR recommending for a sanction here, and does it matter whether we find, does OLR's recommendation turn on whether it was done knowingly, or if the court were to determine it was a reckless disregard that he should have known?
Either way, it'd be a violation of the second count, 28.4C, and the recommendation is a private reprimand. And when Mr. Hansen's talking about his inexperience, we recognize that. And however, I wish to point out that this is not a kind of a case. I've been reminded by the OLR director that this is not a kind of a case that is a de minimis kind of case that should be somehow just kind of dismissed, because it's not a case for a diversion, and that's why we supported a private reprimand. Because a diversion under 22.10.3H is not to be used in cases involving dishonesty or misrepresentation, etc. That's not the area for a diversion. So it's not a case where the director said, oh, it's too bad you're inexperienced, we're sorry, go away. This is something that misled a court. The court had to schedule additional proceedings to unravel this entire history of this situation, court time. And for that, we felt that a private or a public reprimand would be appropriate, and I've been directed to essentially argue for permit a private reprimand, although I did point out some cases where there is authority for a public reprimand. But OLR's position is seeking a private reprimand.
Mr. Crone, I have two questions. One, I agree totally with you that you can infer knowledge from conduct. Because you can't open the guy's head and say you knew or you didn't know. You have to get that from the record, from what was testified to or from written documents. I agree with you there. Your obligation was to prove by clear and convincing evidence that there was a violation of the code, right?
Yes.
And And the clear and convincing evidence here is these written document about notice, but he continually denied that he understood that, and that he understood that the May date was a fixed and settled date. And you think that's good enough under the clear and convincing standard, if I understand you?
I think there's enough facts in this record for the referee to conclude, as he did, and fair inferences from these facts that he knew about the date.
My second question is...
Not clearly erroneous findings.
My second question is... Do you think negligence is sufficient under this second count, or does it have to be knowing and reckless? And reckless is generally different. Despite all the synonyms I read to you, reckless is generally different than negligence. Do you think this is negligent is enough, or you think reckless is required?
I think you got to go by the rule, and the rule talks on the second 8.4C, which I assume you're talking about.
Yeah.
The violation is a misrepresentation, which is knowingly or made in reckless disregard.
That's right. So negligence is not enough.
That's correct. I would concede that.
And so therefore, you, at a minimum, I think you would have to say that some language in some of our opinions which refer to negligence and which have been taken in or out of context to make negligence an adequate mens rea, for lack of a better term, they have to be repaired.
Well, yeah, I think that if you
yes or no, yes?
The decisions have to be cleared up?
Yeah.
That'd be helpful.
Good. Well, that's important because it goes to show that the court's drafting is sometimes a little, leaves something to be desired. So I'm a little, what shall I say, more lenient about the word notice, because I think that is just careless use of a language, or could be so construed. Now, the referee didn't construe it that way, and then the question is whether or not the referee's construction is appropriate.
Right. We don't have under the law to prove the tort of misrepresentation, or fraud to be to fall under this. And there are some cases that suggest negligence might fall under it as well, although I don't read it that way.
Okay. Let me just talk about reckless for a moment. Where does the referee deal with reckless?
Well, he doesn't. He deals with it when he finds that there's been a violation of 8.4C.
Yeah, but then you have to. He makes a conclusion that there's no that there's a violation. So you're reading into that conclusion a conclusion that this was reckless, well, reckless or knowing, right?
Yes.
Well, is that very good drafting by the referee?
I don't know that he has to make a finding of every word in the rule if he finds the rule violated.
Well, mens rea is not just anything in the rule. I mean, it's the basis. We agree no, and we agree reckless, and you agree the court's decisions on negligence are need repair, right?
Right.
So I don't know when he finds that a violation is that. Why isn't he thinking it's negligence? I don't know what he's thinking. The court has problems on negligence and reckless. Why isn't the referee, if he's looking at the court's decisions, having problems between reckless and negligence?
I've never seen a situation where a referee made a decision of a violation of a Supreme Court rule, and then the court is second-guessing that decision, saying, did you make a finding, specific finding of this, 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 and this, when in fact he found that the rule was violated?
I guess that's a longer way of saying it. What difference does it make? We're in as good a position to take the facts and apply our case law in order to determine whether the rule was violated. That might be another way of saying what you just said.
Thank you.
Well, should this court be making findings? I mean,
that wouldn't be making a finding.
Well, we affirm the referee's findings unless they're clearly erroneous. So we have a few standards that we apply when there's a referee in an OLR case. So. But if we would determine they were clearly erroneous, we certainly could do that.
You could, and I don't think they are in this case, not even close, right. But that would be the basis for you to do that, and the only basis.
Well, if
or concluded that the referee was basing the conclusion on a negligence standard, then we would need to find that clearly erroneous, wouldn't we?
Well, I don't know that you could. I wasn't anticipating this kind of question, frankly. I don't know how to answer that, really. I'm going to have to punt on that question. Can I punt here?
While you're pondering that one, I've got another one for
okay.
you.
Okay. I'll come back to your question when I get a flash of brilliance.
Well, how long is this going to take?
Hopefully my light will...
The light's still green. Does it matter at all here how Judge Slate perceived whether Attorney Hansen was attempting to deceive the court? Because I'm looking at the record of the transcript, and it appears to me that Judge Slate said the same thing two different ways. I guess I'm putting it on to you as very honestly, sir, addressing Attorney Hansen. It seems as though you're just not familiar with the process of how these things work in the state of Wisconsin. And then he later said, Attorney Hansen, I, with all due respect to you, your pleadings and actions in this case lead me to believe that you simply are not familiar with Wisconsin legal process. Should the court give that any weight?
The judge in the civil court, that was on a motion to reconsider, and I think the standard was excusable neglect. And Judge Slate found that there was not the basis for excusable neglect. In that particular decision, if you read all of what Judge Slate said, he said a lot of things, some that we by stipulation struck from the record, where he was highly critical of Mr. Hansen's means of practice and questioned whether he really knew about the state or not and so forth. But he did say what you said as well. There's a lot in there. I'm not so sure. I'm not asking you to rely significantly upon what he said or did, favorable or unfavorable to our position, because it was in a different context of a motion with a different standard of review of what his own decision, and whether his conduct, Hansen's conduct, was excusable or not.
So we have to look at the referee's report.
Right.
And referee's
right.
statements.
I haven't researched this. Supreme Court Rule 22.23 deals with publication of disposition. It is the general practice that if a private reprimand is imposed, and that's the max that you're asking for, or if there is a dismissal, the decision is not published. The rule that I refer to states, with the exception of the Supreme Court's disposition of a private reprimand or dismissal of a proceeding, the Supreme Court's disposition of a proceeding under this chapter shall be published in an official report. Now, it doesn't specifically say, and then it goes on to say, a party may file a request to publish a dismissal of a proceeding. Under this rule, does this rule allow for or provide for the publication of a dismissal or private reprimand absent the request of a party?
And where is that rule again that you just referred to?
22.23. If you're not familiar, you may not be with the publication rules of disposition. So if you are interpreting this like for the first time or looking at it for the first time, I'm just really wondering if you know of that rule and if there are instances that you could point to where absent a request by a party, the court under that rule still published a private reprimand or a dismissal. Are you familiar with any of that?
I'm not really that familiar with the rule, but it seemed that would strike me as being somewhat strange to absent a request.
I think you'll find that whether it's published or not, namely in the Wisconsin reports, the compendium will have a discussion of something that came up here with a private reprimand and may or may not have the name of the attorney in it, but we'll have a discussion of the facts and the holding of the court so that that's information to other attorneys and to the OLR itself. I think that's what, even though it's not public.
That's right. I'm just not familiar with the circulation of our compendium.
Well, it's online now. It was hard copy, but now it is online.
It seems to me in closing here that Mr. Hansen's position is he didn't see the date for this motion.
Pardon me?
Mr. Hansen's position is that he didn't see the date of the motion.
That's right.
And there's really no corroborating evidence for that that he's presented.
No, so, but there's no evidence that he's not telling the truth.
Well, but there is evidence that he certainly had many opportunities to look at the date, and the date was in his file.
Yeah, and he's looking at it and looking at it and looking at it, and according to him, he's saying, oh, that's the suggested date of the attorney. It is not the court date.
And
I have to wait for the court to say. So, I mean, it's a question whether you believe that or you don't believe it, therefore his conduct of not showing up and his conduct of reading it supports the referee.
There's many, many opportunities for him to ultimately see that date. He chose to keep his head in the sand, and I don't feel there's a basis for a dismissal in this case.
I have a question that much of the case depends on the fact that he didn't know. He doesn't know the practice. He doesn't know the procedure. He doesn't know maybe the law of motions and setting dates in this state. And yet we take the view, which is a fiction, that everyone knows the law. So even if he weren't an attorney, we would say he knows. Are you relying on that concept that you're supposed to know the law?
Well,
you
attribute
that to him?
The rules apply to everybody. The rules apply to everybody. His inexperience may cut in his favor in terms of sanction, and that's what we considered. And that's what we considered private reprimand because of his inexperience.
I'm looking at Appendix L, page 17. This is a fairly unique case, the underlying case here, right? I mean, this was the second time that the lawyer for one of the parties blew a court date, right? What happened to the lawyer the first time around? I mean, I'm looking at the judge's transcript. This particular case is unique in that there was already a previous attorney who missed the defendant's summary judgment hearing. There was an appeal. The Court of Appeals kicked that back to the trial court and required the court to conduct an investigation as to whether or not it was the attorney's or the client's fault. The court held that hearing. You and your client were aware of this. This is not your normal case. There was a misdate in the past. It goes on. Do you know whether that lawyer who missed that court date ended up facing discipline?
There is nothing in the record on that subject.
Okay.
So anything said or done by anybody here is not a part of the record. I don't think should be considered. No, whatever that was all about had nothing to do with OLR's bringing this case or prosecuting it. I have no idea personally what happened there, and I don't think it'd be appropriate for anybody to comment on it because it really wasn't part of the findings.
It just sort of proves the point. Lawyers occasionally mess up, but unfortunately to these poor people it happened twice in the same case, which may be in no small measure why the judge was not willing to.
And if I leave you with any thoughts, I would agree that lawyers do occasionally mess up, but we're not here because the lawyer messed up. We're here because the lawyer, we feel, either in reckless disregard or knowingly, as those words are liberally defined, misled the trial court and made a misrepresentation. And that's something that the courts can't
help. Before you sit down, do you have any insight into the question that was asked, which I think was, is it clearly erroneous if the referee based his decision on negligence?
Well, I don't know the answer to that because he didn't do that. He doesn't make reference to negative. Yeah.
So it's just so not in the record as to what he based his decision on.
No, I
other
think
than
he based his decision on the violations that were pled and by OLR misrepresentation.
Did you plead reckless, or did you plead knowing, or didn't you plead anything?
Those are part of the definitions, Justice Abrams.
So you didn't. Yeah, you just pled a violation of this code.
Of the rules, and then the rules incorporate those definitions.
Right.
So.
I understand that. Thank you.
So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I never did get back here.
Think we have.
Sorry, time's up.
All right. Attorney Dykeman.
Marshall said that I could stand at the podium for rebuttal, and so I am. All 8 findings that were made by the referee, and I would have hoped, but I didn't have a chance to explain why all 8 of them have a significant difficulty and problem. They have 2 things in common, all 8 of them. Nowhere does the referee find that Hansen knew of the May 8 date before Hansen sent his May 14 letter. Nowhere in his findings does the referee infer that Hansen had that knowledge when he sent the letter. I'm not sure really then, as I guess I've had a lot of trouble in determining what is OLR basing its conclusion on. One of these findings had to do with a status conference. The status conference, the finding is just plain incorrect. At the status conference, Hansen admitted. That does not exist. The status conference was unreported. Nobody has a hard copy of anything showing what was said or discussed. Hansen quoted the complainant's Mazzaro's relevant testimony in full in his brief at page 19. Mazzaro, when asked about his recollection of the status conference, replied, "Not really. I really don't have much of a memory of it." He didn't know when Hansen said that he had received the date, omitting when Hansen discovered the date, when he eventually discovered it, after he wrote his May 14 letter. There's no evidence in the record, and I would ask the court to read that record, that Hansen knew of the date on or before May 14. Now, the rest of the findings have similar deficiencies. They have 2 things in common. Nowhere does the referee find that the date before, I'm sorry, nowhere does the referee find that Hansen knew of the May 8 date before he sent his May 14 letter. And so I think that's the crux of this case. What did he know? And that's just what Justice Prosser said in his dissent in Riley. And I think the plurality opinion would agree with that, although I guess it's in the mind of the beholder or reader. But I don't think the plurality, which with Justice Prosser made 4 justices, would say that you don't have to know in order to be convicted of 28-4C. I think that what is important is the burden of proof. And of course, clear, satisfactory, and convincing, and from Riley, it has to be strong also. But I think that the real question then is, what's the definition of clear, satisfactory, strong, and convincing? Wisconsin has not come up with that, but California has. A case called In the Conservatorship of Wendland which is 26 Cal 4th 5119 at 552, defines clear and convincing, doesn't add the other two, as sufficiently strong to command the unhesitating assent of every reasonable mind. And I think that is so important because just like in criminal cases, there's a reason to have a high standard of proof. And that is we want to make sure that we're not convicting people who are innocent of the crime. And I think something similar to a slightly less extent is we want to make sure that we are not convicting attorneys of things that at least they say that they didn't do. Instead, we look at the record to see what was proven. And I guess my conclusion here is nothing was proven. First of all, as to a comment that Hansen didn't prove anything, well, of course he didn't prove anything. He didn't have to. The burden was on OLR, and indeed he didn't have to prove something, and indeed did not. He also testified that there was an office procedure, and you can see that in the record. The office procedure went through two secretaries, each of whom was to look for dates. Neither of them did it, and unfortunately, neither did Hansen.
Thank you very much. Well, an interesting case, as these usually are. Your briefs were very helpful, and we will now adjourn for the day and meet in closed conference at 10 minutes after 3 o'clock.